The following program is a presentation of the Fly Pod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
The Breakfast Lecture Series is sponsored by Mr. Prince Johnson, Small Business and Family Solutions Representative for Legal Shield, one of the first companies in the United States to offer affordable legal plans for businesses and individual consumers. Our shared mission is to ensure immediate access to quality legal counsel, no matter how trivial or traumatic you think your issue may be. Our network of attorneys are experienced in the areas of law that will impact the growth of your business and the protection of your family. Our network of legal firms currently provide competent, affordable attorneys in 49 states and Canada. We're growing fast with just over 1.5 million members and serving 140,000 businesses. We also provide comprehensive solutions to identity theft, one of the fastest growing categories of crime. With our new mobile apps, you'll discover peace of mind while having a law firm in the palm of your hand for an affordable monthly fee. To learn more, contact your tri-state area Legal Shield representative, Mr. Prince Johnson, at 513-476-5888.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Tom Tinnis, and on behalf of the Breakfast Lecture Series and the Cincinnati Masonic Center, I'd like to welcome you to this morning's Breakfast Lecture Series featuring Hamilton County Coroner Dr. Lakshmi Sammarco. Recently re-elected Hamilton County Coroner, Dr. Lakshmi Sammarco is a board-certified neuroradiologist who has a clinical practice in Cincinnati. Dr. Sammarco's previous employment includes faculty neuroradiology positions at the Cleveland Clinic, the University of Maryland Medical School in Baltimore, and the UCLA Medical Center in Los Angeles. She is currently licensed in 9 states. In Cincinnati, she has worked as a radiologist at local hospitals before starting her own specialty radiology services company, NeuroRad Pro LLC. Raised and educated in Cincinnati, Dr. Sammarco graduated early from Cincinnati Country Day School, then attended the University of Cincinnati College of Engineering before graduating from the University of Cincinnati's Medical School as the youngest student in her class. Dr. Sammarco is actively involved in the local community and often speaks at area high schools, emphasizing the importance of education and career choices. Please join me in welcoming to the Breakfast Lecture Series, Dr. Lakshmi Sammarco, Hamilton County Coroner.
Thank you, everybody. So I apologize for my tardiness. I was preparing, I had a kid to get to school, getting my luggage. I'm leaving straight from here to the airport. And then we had some technical issues. A lot of people say, well, what exactly do you guys do in the coroner's office? You know, is it just death investigation? Do you do more than that? And it was a late night last night, by the way. The phone kept ringing, so which is not a good thing when you're coroner. So we between a homicide and then one of the councilmen in one of our local communities is a presumed overdose. So, and that just brings everything, you know, every time I say this, people don't understand it, but, you know, the overdose problem, the opiate problem we're having is across all economic and social and geographic boundaries. I mean, this is one of our elected people in Hamilton County. So, those of you who don't know where we are, we're at the corner of Eaton and Goodman Avenues, right across the street from the University of Cincinnati, in this nice brown bunker. That's what it looks like. I mean, there are a couple of windows here and there, but essentially, I think it could be a bomb shelter. I don't think we're designated that way, but I think it could be. So, this building was built in the days of Dr. Cleveland, who was quite the legend, I understand, built in 1973. We are in the process of looking at a piece of land and planning. In fact, yesterday they had interviews of architects to plan a new facility. And, Bob, we're going to be breaking ground before the end of the year, right?
Yes, we are.
So Cushman Wakefield is our project manager, so we put them on the spot. Any chance we get. I don't know if any of you remember these, but I don't know if this video will play. Aha! Who remembers this show? Because I cut my teeth on this show. All right? Yeah, that's pretty accurate. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. So, what are the qualifications to be a coroner? Every state's a little bit different. Indiana, for example, you don't have to be a physician. In the state of Ohio, you do. So in Ohio, you either have to have an MD or a DO. And you have to be licensed to practice in the state of Ohio, and you had to have been practicing the 2 years immediately preceding taking the office. During the term, we are required to attend continuing medical education from the Ohio State Coroners Association, which puts on an annual meeting in different places. We had it here in Cincinnati in 2013. I think we're due again, so we'll probably have another big one. So 34 states use the coroner system, and 16 states in D.C. use a medical examiner system. And the difference really is a coroner is elected, a medical examiner is appointed. And, you know, I've had it, and how did it start? It started with the old British kings wanting to collect their last, you know, pound of flesh or ounce of flesh or, you know, wanting to tax people and not, if they don't know who died, then they can't tax the estate. So here comes a coroner who's supposed to keep track of all these deaths and report to the king. So if you're elected, you're appointed essentially by the taxpayers. And you're accountable to the taxpayers. If you're appointed, you're appointed by a small group of people, whoever those people are, politicians or business group, whatever. But they're the ones that can tell you what to do. And we have been in situations in this county, in my terms, where there have been people that have suggested I rule a certain way on cases, whether there was evidence or not. And my response is, thank you for your input. If I find that evidence, we will rule that way. Otherwise, we won't. That hasn't made too many friends along the way, but it is the way it is. You know, in our office, and this is one thing that everybody in our office really believes, we're in the business of keeping innocent people out of jail, much more so than putting the bad guys in jail. And it's very important to us that the innocent stay free, but we're also very interested in making the community safe for all of us. So we like to pretend we're here. And our project manager assures us by the time we're done with our building, we are going to be state-of-the-art and, you know, be able to solve crimes in 40 minutes minus commercials. This is actually an old video, too. I was realizing this. So that's kind of our crew and our morgue and forensic of pathology crew. So we don't solve crimes in an hour in general, and we don't have all those fancy things that you see. I get that question all the time. But it's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of tedious work. It's, you know, scientists just sitting at their area doing their work, I mean, day in and day out. And we're constantly encountering things that we've never seen before. I mean, it's every day. So we have two different divisions. We have the morgue division, and then we have the crime lab division. So what does a morgue division do? The morgue division, or the coroner division, is mandated by law. So much as some of the commissioners in the past tried to hand off our office to the state crime lab, they can't hand off the coroner's division. That is mandated by law. So what's the primary responsibility? We try and identify the dead through all these different processes, and then we'll process her personal effects, and we will try and determine cause and manner of death. That's what we do in the coroner division. Crime lab division will assess anything that is related to a crime. So I've been asked before, hey, can you guys test X, Y, and Z? If it has a criminal case number on it, yes. Otherwise, no. Because that's what we do. We analyze the criminal evidence. So talking about our forensic science, we have several different things that we do in our office. We have four major divisions. We have the firearms division. Firearms people will evaluate guns, bullets, shell casings, and tool marks, and anything that's used to commit a crime. So if somebody uses a book, smacks somebody on the head, and they end up dying, that's a weapon. And our firearms people will look at that. Sometimes it's a physical fit. Sometimes it's finding DNA evidence on it. But our firearms section will do all of that. We've got four full-time firearms techs. They're pretty amazing. We have new technology called NIBIN, which is essentially, it's called the National Integrated Ballistics Information Network. And what that means is that we're connected to a nationwide database where all of the processing that we do of the firearms and the shells and the bullets all get put into that, and then it gets matched across the country, different jurisdictions, different states, the feds to the locals. And when there is a match, in other words, there are circumstances that look like the same gun was used, we're able to put all that information together and follow these criminals. So we had a case not too long ago where this guy had killed somebody here in Cincinnati and then killed somebody else in Detroit, and we were able to match the information and be able to track him. So our trace evidence section, they're the real CSI people. I mean, we have three trace evidence specialists, including our crime lab director, who is actually a world-renowned gunshot residue expert. He's one of seven people that sets the standards across the world for gunshot residue investigation. And so they look at everything from wood chips, paint chips, hairs, carpet fibers, fabrics, ignitable fluids, because they're part of the arson team, to shoe prints. So yesterday I walked into the trace evidence section and they were examining shoe print from a crime scene. Serology is our DNA section. Then we have our drug section, and then toxicology, which is tied into the coroner's division where they're evaluating body fluids. So you'll notice we don't have a whole lot of space. So this is our trace evidence section. We've got a lot of these microscopes, and this is actually our part of our firearms section that's spilled out into the trace section. It's a comparison microscope where you can actually, we'll be able to compare one bullet to another, a test-fired bullet to one from a gun that was found at a scene, or a bullet that was taken out of a body, and we'll be able to compare the bullets and see if they match. So this is our firing tank in our garage. It's full of fluid. It's full of water. We test fire a gun that's found at a scene or one that they want us to test. We'll collect the bullet from within the tank. So this is our firing range. So this is upstairs in our firearm section, and we really don't use it anymore. As you can see, you really can't use it. This is only like 15 feet. And, you know, you shoot through the little rubber membrane and you collect the bullets on the other. We just can't use it. But this is the end of a gun. This is a magnified end of a gun. And what I'm trying to show you is every gun has these things called grooves and lands. Every single gun, even if it's exact same manufacturer, same caliber, et cetera, as the next gun, will have its own fingerprint, because these will make an impression on the bullet as it spins out and it comes out. We use a comparison microscope to look at those marks. So here's one where you have one bullet. I don't remember which one was taken out of a body and which one was a test fire, but this is a second bullet. And the comparison microscope will project the images together in one image, and then you can use this cursor line to move back and forth so that you can follow these lines and grooves and see if there's a match. As I said, our trace evidence section does all of this and then some. So they really have to be certified in each and every single one of these entities, and it's very painstaking. And we also have an electron microscope, a scanning electron microscope, which has to be on ground level, because it can magnify things to 100,000 times. And so even a tiny little bit of a shake, as you can imagine, can make a difference. So this is actually on the ground level. We have to pour liquid nitrogen in to keep it cooled. And this is very useful for looking at gunshot residue and anything else that we're looking at when we're looking for really minute data. So this is our trace evidence section without the people in it. We have these two bays. Actually, this bay is gone, but these are the only places where we can actually open evidence. as you can see, we're very limited on the number of cases we can open at once, which is why it takes so long. And then this is coming out of our firearm section. So Emily is one of our trace evidence specialists. And what she's doing here is this was a sweater from a hit-and-run victim. We have white sheets of paper we put in our bays, and she's scraping down the sweater to try and get evidence off the sweater. We're looking for anything that can help us figure out what car might have hit it. So in some of the stuff that's scraped down, here's a little marker. You see this little paint chip. And this is at 10 times magnification. At 20 times, you're seeing a little more definition in that paint chip. And at 50 times, you can really see that there's crystals and layers and yellow paint in the middle. And then this is known paint. This is paint from a known car, a car that we suspected was the one that hit him. So there's not only the physical fit. If it's a big enough paint chip, you can kind of make it fit into a spot that might be missing on the car. But then you can look at the layers and the composition of the paint chips and see if they're a match. So on hairs and fibers, we're looking at a lot of things. We can use hair for in the trace evidence section, but also in the DNA section. So this was an old mask that was used to commit a crime, a bank robbery, actually. And this little hair that you see at the edge of the blue here was taken off of that. So when you look at a hair, everybody's hair is different. Even if it's exact same color, and you have two black hairs, they're going to be very different from person to person. Because the hair shaft has all of these different bits and pieces to it. So every single one is going to be different per person. So one person is going to have the same looking, so the same ovoid bodies and the pigment and the medulla, but it's going to be different than somebody else with black hair. So, and here's an example, even with the different colors of hair, but you can see all the different markings that you can get. And it's useful for a lot of things. You don't need DNA for everything. I think everybody, there is this whole CSI effect where juries are expecting us to have DNA evidence on everything. And our DNA section is 400 cases behind. Each case may have one submission or 30 submissions. That's how many things that they have to analyze. So we occasionally have issues with judges demanding everything being rushed. Well, if everything is rushed, the other cases are getting pushed behind. But we do the best we can with the four full-time DNA analysts that we have. But we're also space limited, and that's also a room where we have limitations in electricity. So we can't plug in all our equipment that we need at the same time. So we have to do process one, finish, unplug, and then plug in process two and move things in. So it really makes things cumbersome. This was a suspect's hair. As you can see, that's a match. I mean, you don't even have to do a DNA analysis to say that that's a match. Fibers work very much the same way. Natural fibers have a lot of different irregularities, and man-made fibers are very smooth in general. So this is an electron microscope image of cotton, and you can see all the irregularities in cotton. Man-made fibers have a different light fluorescence, and they're smoother. So shoe prints. What do we do with shoe prints? Well, this is a Converse shoe. It's hilarious because you go to a school, high school, I can't tell you how many kids just know this right off the bat. It's like, I don't think I ever looked at what shoe prints were when I was a kid, but they all know it. So it's like, I just say, hey, anybody know what this is? Oh yeah, it's a Converse shoe. Okay, well, even if you have the same size shoe, the exact same shoe as your neighbor, and it's a Converse shoe, you're going to have different shoe prints because you step on different things. You put different weight. You may drag your heel. It may be worn at the toe. So everybody's shoe print is going to be different unless it's a brand spanking new shoe. I think it was about 3 weeks ago, I walked into our trace evidence section. We had 80 shoes sitting there because they were looking to try and match a shoe from a shoe print from a scene. So you can see in this is a known lift or a known shoe print that we took from a suspect's shoe. And we can see a couple of these little distinctive markings here. So this isn't perfect, but, you know, the shoe prints at scenes aren't perfect, and so you kind of make do. But you can see that some of these things are here. And you can match some of these things up. and pretty confidently say, yeah, that's probably that shoe. And then unfortunately, we also have had shoe prints on people. And although this is an adult, I can tell you that I have personally seen shoe prints on children. So we've had child abuse victims in our office who have come in with shoe prints and, you know, physical marks on them. So how many of you knew this? One in four fires in Hamilton County is due to arson. Actually, I think it's gone up to one in three now. I mean, that's a huge number. I never realized that it was that high in Hamilton County. So what we try to do with the arson team is we try and assist them in discovering the ignitable fluids and what they could be. And the arson team goes into the ruins, basically, and they look and see. So we were at the big house fire in Indian Hill, and even 4 or 5 days later, there were things still burning. And a couple of the firefighters actually burned themselves as they were collecting evidence. It was so hot, everything was melted, and we were sifting, literally, with sifters going through it, looking for evidence. But when you're looking for accelerants, these canines are really helpful. Sniff out these accelerants, and it's much safer to send the dogs in there where we don't know if there is any accelerant or not. So gunshot resident, I love this question because every TV show says, well, he had GSR on him, so obviously he fired the gun. Yeah, no, that's not the way it works. So if there is GSR, gunshot residue, on a person, whether it's on their clothing, on their feet, on their shoes, on their... So I'm going to the airport today. I had to change my shoes from the firearms section because, you know, that there is GSR on the shoes. So it could mean that they fired the gun, absolutely. But it could also mean that they handled a gun that was fired, or they could have just been in the room or near somebody who fired the gun. And this always becomes an issue when there's an unwitnessed shooting. And last year, unfortunately, we had a suicide victim who was a young kid from one of the high schools. He used a rifle in his home, and you know, they were suspecting the father because they'd had an argument, and the father had found him, and so he had moved the gun, and then he tried to resuscitate his son, and so he had gunshot residue on him. You know, he had it on his hands, and they were trying to make an argument that, well, the kid couldn't have possibly reached the trigger and put it up against his forehead, and so we were doing measurements and doing all this. But, I mean, it really was a suicide, and we were able to clear the father. But so when a gun is shot, you see all this gas and powdery stuff that's coming out, and there's a bullet. That's the gunshot residue. That's that stuff that's coming out and ending up everywhere. And using an electron microscope, that's what it looks like. Not very impressive, but that's what it looks like on the skin. So what does that really mean, though? Because you can't get a good idea. Well, this is a hair follicle on the back of a hand of somebody, and gunshot residue is that small. This is our firearms team and our trace evidence team, and Mike Trimpe is in the middle. He's our crime lab director. So here's the infamous ping pong table in our office that everybody keeps talking about. But nobody asked me why we have a ping pong table in our office. Nobody plays ping pong in our office. We don't even have any ping pong balls. So, you know, in our DNA section, we don't have enough bench space to spread out on anything. Acryl fentanyl. Haven't seen that before. Just started coming in. So we think we've had at least one death due to that, but it's been in our drug section because it's been seized by law enforcement in different crimes. So that, I think, makes the 7th fentanyl analog that we've had to discover in the last 6 months, including carfentanil being one of them. We're not seeing carfentanil as much anymore, but we are seeing these other variants. So yesterday we got into a discussion about, okay, now we have to come up with a whole new protocol of how to test for this. And yesterday we also found out our drug section just informed us, and then we have to tell our toxicology section, ketamine is starting to show up mixed with heroin and fentanyl. and this is new. And why are they mixing ketamine with this? We don't know. I mean, they had been mixing cocaine with that, the speedball, but maybe the ketamine decreases some of the withdrawal effects of the opiates. We're not sure. Anyway, so that's a new thing that our toxicology section now has to specifically test for. And our toxicology section, our last section, is we study the stuff in the body fluids, right? So what causes overdose? We do all the DUI cases in the county. So do they have alcohol? Do they have drugs in their system? This is a little chart that shows blood alcohol percentage, just to give people an idea of how many drinks it takes to make somebody impaired. So, you know, for men, it's usually a couple of drinks. Driving skills are affected. For women, depending on how big they are, it could be one. So I don't know how many of you remember the old Tylenol scare with the tainted Tylenol. Well, it was a toxicologist that discovered that there was cyanide mixed in with the Tylenol. And, you know, a couple of years ago, they thought that they found the person that did that, but it turned out it wasn't. This was a great case. This woman married a law enforcement person in Florida, and I'll give you the short version. She made him get life insurance. Then she poisoned him with antifreeze because he wasn't feeling very well. I went to the hospital. The hospital said clear liquids. Well, antifreeze doesn't have a color or a smell, and she mixed it in with the Jell-O, and he ended up dying. He had calcium oxalate crystals in his kidneys. Well, they never figured that out. She went and married somebody else and did the same thing in another state. And that coroner figured it out and were able to put her away. And then she ended up taking an overdose. So every once in a while, and this is the last thing I want to cover, we'll occasionally get bones. Just bones, nothing else. And then we call Beth Murray over at the College of Mount St. Joe to come over and help us with identifying bones. One of the things we're starting to do right now, that's actually a body in a CT scanner, and we've done about 140 virtual autopsies with the assistance of the University of Cincinnati. And this is actually just a sinus CT, but you can look at how much information you can get just from a 10-second sinus CT that you go through. And so we're using some of that information. Recently, we had a case, the Butler County case of the Chris Davis, the gentleman who was in the car that was hit by the van and then ended up dying. So he had lots of imaging, and they brought it all to us, and we took a look at all the imaging and tried to see how much information we can get just from the imaging before even doing the autopsy. But these are bullets, these little star-like things, and this is just a CT scan. We told the computer we want to see it in a bone algorithm, and it gives you that much information. Here's a CT scan again of somebody that was shot in the head. Then you can actually see the skull. So this guy was a drug mule. He tried to, you know, put these under his tongue, and these are little capsules of drugs to transport them. One of them broke, and he ended up dying, overdosing. But this is what it looks like when you can just take a plain CT scan. You see him on either side of the tongue, and he was hiding them. This is another one who swallowed them. These are in his bowel. So I use that at the schools because, you know, I tell kids, you're trying these drugs. Do you know where they've been? Do you know whose body they traveled through? Because you have no idea, unless you planted that poppy plant yourself, where the drugs have been in between. So you want to put something in your mouth that came out of somebody else? That usually gets the kids. So this is a CT scan and an MRI scan, but you can see the path of the bullet. And then this is an MRI scan where you can see it was a stab wound, and this is the anterior wall of the heart, the front wall of the heart, with a hole in it. Actually, that was it. Thank you.